Good morning. I'm Dave Barnard, Head of Global Sales here at Sanford Bernstein, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to this morning's fireside chat with Bob Iger, CEO of The Walt Disney Company. We're delighted to have Bob, Lowell Singer, and the rest of the Disney team back here at the SDC once again. I'd also like to welcome Andrew Slabin of GLG and Steve Warner of AllianceBernstein to this morning's session, where they will be serving as the role of moderator. Andrew and Steve will lead off the questioning this morning, but we will be looking for input from the audience, and we'll take your questions with the question cards that were on the seats as you arrived this morning. Please fill them out and pass them to the center aisle, where they will be collected and brought to the front of the room. Just one piece of business I'd like to cover before I hand it over. I'd like you to note that since neither GLG or AllianceBernstein publishes research or internal ratings, nothing from today's presentation should be interpreted as a recommendation to buy or sell Walt Disney Security. So with that out of the way, I'm pleased to hand it over to Bob, Andrew, and Steve. Thank you.
Thanks. Bob, if we just start off, thinking about the role that a CEO plays in today's media industry. It seems the hardest job that you guys might have is figuring out how to maximize your revenues with a sort of proliferation of distribution platforms. So how do you make sure that you protect the revenues you have currently and develop new areas for the business to grow?
Well, I start off by stating the obvious. It starts with making great product, and in our case, branded product, and really concentrating on improving quality and consistency when it comes to success creatively, and putting our capital in branded directions, because we think, generally speaking, our returns on invested capital, particularly in the film entertainment space, are higher when we invest in our quality brands. So Disney, Pixar, Marvel, good example, ESPN, all great examples of that. Clearly, we are faced today with myriad new distribution opportunities, and we've taken a position as a company to be present on those platforms for a variety of reasons. One, we see people using these new platforms more and more, mostly because of how compelling they are: convenience, mobility, higher quality screens, etc., ubiquity. So we feel that we need to be present where our consumers are. There's, for some extent, it's a brand relevance issue, but we also believe that that's in the long-term best interest of the company in terms of generating revenue on these platforms. We also believe that status quo is not an option. If we just basically keep our content on the traditional platforms and people migrate to the new ones, we're not going to slow that process down by staying on the traditional ones. There's still, people will still find content experiences on the new platform, so we think we have to be there. Piracy is another issue. Bringing product to market on a well-timed, well-priced basis on new platforms in particular is really important, because if we don't, people will find ways to steal them or use devices to gain access to them where we will not have any opportunity to monetize. So I think that for a number of reasons, we feel that while current platform revenue is certainly important and it's to be respected, it's not necessarily to be protected at the cost of not occupying space on new media platforms.
Because one of the things that, recently on Time Warner had an analyst day last week, and three large film companies have decided to sort of change how they window film content: Warner Brothers, Fox, and Universal, and they've put in 28-day windows for Netflix and Redbox, and you guys have obviously gone down a different path. So maybe you can explore a little bit about why your strategy is different than their strategy.
Well, first of all, we have a higher conversion rate in terms of box office to sell-through. So our sell-through business is more robust than our competitors in general. And when we analyzed the cost of creating that window in Redbox, which would have entailed us selling them videos at substantially reduced prices, we would not have made as much money in the system or through the system of basically renting and selling our videos. We've not seen any significant cannibalization from the dollar Redbox rental window. And with that in mind, selling them units at 50% reduction in cost or whatever the proposition, even for the 28-day window, was not an equation that made sense to us. It might make perfect sense to them. On the Netflix side, we have a new deal that I won't get into too much detail with, but through our new Starz deal, there are incentives so that if our films are consumed at a higher rate on Netflix, we actually, at a certain level, we actually have an opportunity to increase revenue from that.
I want to ask a question about ESPN, but before I go to that, in terms of the comments you just made, clearly companies are doing different things. They're experimenting in different platforms at different times. Steve mentioned some studios using a window. Certainly, when it comes to TV product, some studios are using certain online platforms, some aren't. I think NBC and Time Warner said recently they weren't going to conform their content to an iPad application. The question I have there is, do you think there's a point in time, and maybe it's too early for this, but a point in time where the consumer gets confused about where they can get content, how they can get content, and at what times it's available? Is that something that you, as an industry leader or an industry executive, think about in terms of a standardization for the industry?
I think the consumer is pretty smart, and particularly young consumers. Watching young kids navigate the internet or navigate an iTouch or an iPhone or an iPad for that matter, even though I realize not that many kids have them yet, but certainly iTouch, a lot of kids do. I think that we sell the consumer short if we think that they're not going to be able to find stuff easily. First of all, you have devices that are providing much better user interface and navigation, sort of middleware, so to speak, that's much better than it used to be. You have higher speed connectivity, so switching costs between content or between sites or between apps is much less than it used to be. One of the most interesting things I found, by the way, about the iPad is the elimination of the cursor and the mouse is pretty interesting in terms of just reduction of friction and improvement of navigation. We're looking long-term at navigation issues and believe that a lot of the issues that consumers had finding things, certainly on traditional platforms, but even in early-stage new platforms, are going to go away. In terms of our decision to make ABC shows available on the iPad, it speaks to some extent to what Steve asked in my response there. We felt that there was value in being on that platform first, that it makes us more relevant. It improves circulation as far as we're concerned. There were huge numbers of ABC have been downloads of the ABC app. We believe that while we are monetizing today through advertising, and that's growing nicely, we will find ways to monetize in far more robust ways in the future, whether it's through varying forms of pay-per-view, pay for the app, or subscription. Like being there early, because what we learned being there early are basically things that we can use to create a competitive advantage later. We did that when we put the shows on abc.com, for instance. You're going to continue to see our company be there front and center on new platforms in varying ways, all with an eye toward improving monetization capability, improving circulation, and basically figuring out how to improve capital returns on all of our filmed entertainment.
It sounds like with some of these changes you articulated, business models are going to evolve and they're going to change from where we see them now.
By the way, that's a very good point because there are a lot of conclusions that seem to have been reached about the current day business model on new media, that it's not monetizable or it's not monetizable in robust ways. It's a little early to kind of write the epitaph of new media when it comes to monetization. If you go back, what was said about a number of new media content platforms, dot-com sites, whatever, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there was a lot that was right and there was a lot that was wrong. I think it's a little too early to write it all off. We find that if you're sitting with a device that has great video, that is mobile, that you can access content very quickly, that you're going to use, you're going to tend to consume more of it. And we like that phenomenon because the more media that's consumed, the better off we are as a company. But you've got to make your product consumable wherever possible.
So nowhere is that more apparent than, I think, what you're doing at ESPN. And recently, having attended the ESPN Upfront, the suite of products that you're rolling out is really nothing short of amazing in terms of the number of places, the ways in which a consumer can access it, streaming games, scores. And some of these things, I think, are on a monthly subscription basis. Some of them are free. Just, again, with respect to Steve's question, running back to how you manage the old and the new, and with ESPN being such an important part of the company, clearly one could say that some of the new products at ESPN are an example of over-the-top video. I'm not suggesting that cable networks will suddenly leave cable distribution companies. But how do you prepare for those discussions with a Comcast or a Time Warner Cable, for example, or Cablevision, when so much of it is available online and being, the proliferation of that content so widely available?
Multiple-choice question sorts or multiple-choice answers. Okay, first of all, ESPN's goal was to be front and center with the sports fan wherever they are. Sports fans, fan is short for fanatic, by the way, are going to find stats, highlights, still photos of some specific play, whatever, all over the place because they demand that. And if we're not there to provide it for them, someone else will. So our goal is be there instead of anybody else and be there for the sports fan, no matter where they are. We still are providing the multi-channel or MVPD, providers of multi-channel services, including ESPN, with huge value at ESPN. It's where you can see everything first, live, on big screens. And the value that we reap is great in that process, and the value that the distributor gets is great. In fact, the ESPN is still, if not the most valuable, one of the most valuable channels that a multi-channel provider provides because, one, it's in demand from their consumers. Two, it's in demand from advertisers, both those that we sell to and those that the cable operator and the satellite provider sell to. So it's a good thing. We are offering some product that could be viewed in the early stages, potentially over the top, but it's pretty limited when you think about it. It's not all of ESPN. And as the ability for consumers to connect the kind of the new mechanism to a big screen grows, then we're going to have to be more careful about that, and there'll be more exclusivity. If you're referring to what's called ESPN3, which was once ESPN360, which is now in 72 million, we have 72 million subscribers, and we're getting paid for that. There's probably more on that today accessible than there might be down the road when you can watch that on bigger screens. We still think that the sports fan, by and large, is going to want to watch a live event on the big screen. And those that don't have access to the big screen like the ability that we're giving them to watch it on a smaller screen versus nothing.
So is it too early to ask, though you probably won't answer, but is it too early to ask, when you look, say, 3, 5 years down the road at a franchise like ESPN, do you think the business model of what's coming into revenue for you from affiliate fees versus what's advertising, does that look very different now than very different in the future than it does now, or
not really
as you go?
No, I think what you'll see with ESPN, we're investing substantial amounts of money, as everyone knows, in programming, both what we license and what we create ourselves. The goal is to provide value to advertisers, to our consumers, and to our distributors. And we fully expect that we're going to be able to increase that value for everybody, including for us, meaning we're going to be able to raise rates on the advertising front and on the distribution front because of the investment in programming. And in addition, we're buying rights to many of these leagues that will enable us to maintain ESPN's brand presence in other forms as well, so that there's a system economics that you have to look at ESPN. Down the road, I think you're still going to see a relatively similar relationship between subscription fees and advertising. Now it's somewhere in the 2-to-1 range. You'll see growth in, I'll call it new media for ESPN, but you're going to again see a blend of advertising and subscription fees there. And I think that will probably be a little closer in terms of relation to one another than it is on the primary service, meaning I don't know that you'll necessarily see sub fees in a 2-to-1 relationship to advertising and new media. But on the main platform, it'll probably remain two to one.
Okay. Thanks.
Bob, whether it's ESPN, which you guys have built an incredible franchise, whether it's not only you, but all of network television, which seems to have had a resurgence over the last couple of years, it seems that the media owners have a much better, are playing with a much stronger hand today than they might have played a couple of years ago. So how do you think about managing...
With whom?
With whether it's advertisers, clearly advertisers versus a year ago, whether it's multi-channel distributors, if you go back 3, 4, 5 years ago, it seems that it's a better relationship. If you talk about theatrical exhibitors, what you have started to do with Alice in Wonderland, what other people are starting to talk about with in terms of having, premium VOD. Where I think 5 years ago people might have thought distribution was going to be a much more powerful driver of the business model, it seems that once again that content is winning out. How do you make sure that the advantages that you might have today, that you don't trade that off for sort of near-term advantages for long-term, for problems in the long term? And I'm thinking about, obviously, the government, regulation, consumers. You might be sitting at a very opportune time today, but you don't want to, take such advantage of that today that next week you invite some regulation into the marketplace.
Well, I think you have to be mindful of the potential backlash both on the regulatory front and on the consumer front. You can't price completely ignorant of either of those entities. But the more value you deliver, certainly on the consumer front, then the more pricing leverage you have. And that, I guess, is true with the distributors as well. So if you're Disney, I won't speak for the other companies, and you're sitting with Disney-branded product, whether it's on the motion picture front or on the TV front, and ESPN and ABC and other channels that we own, and our local stations, which are also market leaders, then you're obviously delivering value, and you've got the ability to price that higher. And I think it's a... You can't get too cavalier about it, and you can't price just because you have leverage. You can't just put any number on it. I think you have to balance sort of short-term desire to increase revenue with the long-term prospects of potential fallout if you do it too fast, too high. On the government front, having had discussions over the years with many different government entities, I don't want to sound cavalier, but I don't think that you were facing imminent danger from a la carte,
mm-hmm.
nor do I believe that the government is going to step in and really regulate pricing. I think there's just too much danger in that, and it's fraught with all kinds of legal complication, potentially. That said, you'll hear certainly from this administration a pro-consumer approach taken in general. And if a company such as ours or others walks over whatever that fine the invisible line is, then you'll probably see some, at least, criticism of it, but not necessarily regulation.
Okay.
And so, I don't know whether I fully answered the question, but I think it's something you have to be careful about.
Right. Because it does also seem, reflecting back on something you said before, when I think about the content companies today and how good the content is, and I think about... whether it's network television, where whether it's shows like Modern Family on ABC or Dancing with the Stars or The Big Bang Theory, there seems to be an explosion of great content coming from network television. Certainly, the movie companies have consolidated, where it seems that there's less the great content comes from 4 or 5 movie companies today, as opposed to what people might have said 10 years ago when there was lots of independence. Certainly, you see that in the sports marketplace that ESPN is such a driver of that. I mean, are you surprised just that as the business has evolved, that the large companies have gotten even better at sort of distributing their coming up with ways to create content more effectively than independents?
Well, let's not forget that Hurt Locker, which
that's a fair point.
Was it Hurt Locker?
Summit. But,
won
Hurt Locker
the Academy Award for Best Picture.
But it did 11.
Best Director.
But it did $15 million in revenues versus.
True.
I'm not sure what the lowest grossing, what G-Force did probably.
Ooh, low blow.
Yeah.
Ooh. I'm not, better than that.
I'm not surprised that content companies have done what they've done versus distributors, to the point you made earlier about content being king or whatever. I'm not suggesting that distributors are chicken liver or whatever. Distribution is still really important, but so is content. And that just doesn't surprise me that we're still standing quite tall. Interestingly enough, with all these new platforms out there, I think in a way, even though there's more fragmentation and more opportunity, we almost stand taller because we've demonstrated countless times that great content can do well on just about any platform. It takes advantage of new technology in ways we might not have imagined 10 years ago. In terms of our ability to continue to thrive, I don't. I guess it's hard to. I'm not that surprised. It wasn't something we were worried about, but it doesn't mean that we're complacent about it either. It doesn't mean just because you've got strong content today that you can just reduce your investment or slow down or basically be complacent about it. It's the process of investing in it, finding great people, retaining great people, making the right bets creatively is ongoing at these companies.
So, moving away, I guess, from the low blow of GeForce, to other content. I mean, clearly, content's at the core of Disney, and many people would argue that you're really in the Disney business as opposed to the broader media and entertainment business. As you said, you sort of stand a bit taller than other companies. Having said that, you have made two relatively transformative acquisitions at the company in your tenure, both with Pixar and recently with Marvel. So I'm curious, just your thoughts with some hindsight at Pixar thus far, the strategic benefits as that content sort of percolates its way through other parts of the company. But also, the Disney company has been a company that focuses, or I think has a strong focus on return on invested capital. So can you talk a little bit about the relevance of those acquisitions within that context of returns, financially and then, again, strategically, to the extent you can?
We are very focused on ROIC. We felt that successful animation of the company was a great way to deliver very strong return on invested capital, as had been demonstrated countless times by Disney in the past. At the time that I became CEO, which was 2005, I had significant concerns about Disney's ability to improve its returns on invested capital in the animation business because we had had a 10-year drought, except for the Pixar relationship. That relationship was ending. I thought that number one priority of mine coming into the job was to figure out a way to improve our returns on invested capital in the animation business. And when I looked at the alternatives, they weren't many. And one of the best that was out there was the acquisition of Pixar. One, because of the access to their IP. Two, their people. Three, their technology. And the technology culture that was Pixar, which actually was one of the added benefits of the acquisition, and probably one that's probably less transparent to people in this room, for instance, because we have added substantial technology might to the company thanks to the people at Pixar. I think the record is pretty clear. We've had Cars, Ratatouille, WALL-E, Up, Toy Story 3 coming out in a couple of weeks, which the jury is still out on, but I can't wait for everybody to see that film. So we've had great creative success. We've had commercial success. We've created a huge franchise in Cars, which is one of the biggest merchandise movies that we've ever had. Tremendous returns on invested capital in that. Go to our theme parks around the world. You'll see significantly increased presence of Pixar in parades and attractions and walk-around characters and themed restaurants, you name it. Consumer products is substantially benefited from that. Our video game business is starting to take advantage of it. We're launching our first Pixar title, self-published with Toy Story 3. Our website presence has grown nicely thanks to that. We're just in open beta on a Cars virtual world, online virtual world, and on and on. And so not only do I believe that the results have been significant in terms of returns, but the future is very, very bright from a creative perspective and from a return perspective. We haven't second-guessed that decision one bit. There have been times, though, I've woken up in a bit of a sweat wondering what would happen if we didn't do that. because it's had such a significantly positive effect on the company. And by the way, there's a whole other benefit, and that's just the cultural benefit of bringing that energy and that creativity into the company.
Maybe if you then could just talk about what the benefits you hope to, 3 years from now when you're sitting at the next Bernstein SDC, and Andrew and I are definitely not asking the questions. What will be the benefits that you'll have wanted to see from Marvel?
Well, in many respects, similar from Pixar, save for perhaps the technology front. Great creativity, great characters and franchises, great storytelling, an ability to leverage success as we've done with Pixar and we do typically with a good animated film across just about all of our businesses: television, motion pictures, consumer products, video games, online presence, international markets, you name it. And our goal when we bought Marvel and our goal today is to continue to create great IP, primarily on the motion picture front, but also and on the publishing front, obviously, but also on the TV front and the games front and the online presence front, and to grow our returns in that regard. It's actually a pretty simple equation for us. The hardest part of it is the creative side, which is one of the biggest challenges that a lot of these companies have, is keeping the creative fresh, relevant, successful.
So speaking on the creative side, at the studio, you've obviously made a big change there in the last 6 months. So maybe you can just walk us through, first of all, how you think about what propels you to make those changes, and then how do you sort of communicate what you want that change to mean to the organization?
Well, I don't want to look back, certainly not in criticism, but I obviously felt that we were in need of leadership change at the studio and had in Rich Ross an executive who demonstrated not only considerable amount of business skill in taking the Disney Channel to where it is today and growing it internationally, but significant creative skills as well. And I wanted in the head of our studio someone that combined both great creativity and really strong business sense, interest in international markets, interest in technology, good marketing abilities as well, and also a change agent, because the movie industry, at least Disney's, I thought was in need of real change in terms of how it looked at its prospects and its business. And he set about to, one, focus on the creativity, made a big change on that front personnel-wise, basically understanding that we're probably going to have 6 to 8 live-action Disney-branded movies a year, of which maybe 4 will be what we'll call tentpoles, a couple of animated films a year from Pixar, Disney Animation, now probably 2 Marvel films a year, and maybe we'll stick with 1 nature film a year, and that's essentially it in terms of focus: Disney, Pixar, Marvel brands. He changed the distribution organization to have basically a global distribution, one distribution organization that was distributing films throughout their lifespan. So instead of having a theatrical distribution group that handed off to a home video group, that handed off to a TV group, it's one distribution and one marketing group as well. So streamlined it and basically tore down walls that existed in the studio. And we have in the studio today an organization that's, I think, focused on the right issues creatively, has the right structure, both in terms of contending with the challenges of its business, but also from an efficiency perspective, and is moving forward in, I think, a speedy and focused and very impressive way.
Maybe we'll ask a couple of questions on the parks, and then we can go to the cards and see if people pick them up. Obviously, there's a lot of discussion amongst the buy-side community, I think in the sell-side community, about CapEx trends at the park. You know, obviously, that there's some cruise ships coming online, some additions you're making to your properties at various gates in Florida and California, global expansion as well. Can you just give us a little bit of context? Because the range that you see out there in terms of where CapEx trends are going, the magnitude, seems to be pretty broad. Can you talk a little bit maybe in terms of where CapEx are trending relative to revenues? We went through periods in the past, I think in the late 90s, where CapEx as a percent of revenue maybe moved up towards the 20% range of revenue, maybe off on numbers, but there's a pretty big bump there. Are we sort of seeing a pig and a python right now, or is this a necessary and one-time things?
Okay, first of all, each decision is made independent of the other decisions. And each one is put through a pretty significant sieve, so to speak, when it comes to analyzing prospective returns on invested capital. And for the benefit of the room, we are launching two cruise ships, one in January of 2011, the other one approximately a year later. We are expanding and fixing Disney's California Adventure in California, which opened in 2001 and was in need of, I thought, significant change. We're redoing a good part of the Magic Kingdom in Orlando, which is our number one park. Fantasyland is being redone. We're building what's primarily a vacation club or timeshare resort and hotel in Hawaii. We're expanding Hong Kong Disneyland, which was also necessary, and we're making some modest increases in size to our second gate in Paris. I don't think I left anything out. Again, each one was analyzed very carefully in terms of the needs of the business and our goals from a return on invested capital perspective. In terms of CapEx and the Pig and the Python and a percent of revenue, I don't think we've ever really been that specific, but in the late 1990s, CapEx was probably above 20% of revenue. It may have gone as high as 25% and maybe higher in certain years. We're not looking at that now. If you project out, not all the spending hits in one year, by the way, but if you look at a five-year span from roughly 2009 to 2014, you're not looking at CapEx spending as a percent of revenue on average being above 20%. It is higher than it has been because of all those projects, but it is not at the same level as it was in the late 1990s. Now, one reason, obviously, is that our revenue is higher today than it was back then as well. We're probably spending more in total CapEx, but against, obviously, a much bigger revenue picture. I'd say that this period of spending is, I'll call it mildly aberrational, meaning I think once we get through this period, we're probably going to drop down to what I'll call a more steady state. We'll have increased CapEx needs to essentially manage the increased footprint of our parks and resorts organization, but we don't really project, save for Disneyland Shanghai, should we be successful in completing that agreement and building the park. We don't really project anything as significant as this collection of investments on the CapEx front over the next decade.
Right. I mean, some of the things you mentioned are fixing, but primarily the things you mentioned are expansion of your capacity, etc.
The cruise ships, we have had nice double-digit returns on invested capital, and when we looked at that overall business, we're still relatively small in the scheme of things from a capacity perspective, and we're a different product. We're premium priced to the market. I thought we haven't had an opportunity with two new ships to expand our horizons, no pun intended, with more itineraries, and we're going to take advantage of that with Alaska, Southern California, Mexico, and parts of Europe, maybe down the road, Asia or Hawaii. That was an independent decision based on what had been a very good experience and looking very carefully at the marketplace. Magic Kingdom was kind of easy because it's the number one in Florida, number one theme park, and Fantasyland hadn't been touched in any significance in 25 years, and we had an opportunity to take advantage of new IP to put it in there to really revitalize it. California Adventure, completely separate decision. It was a park that was a miss in 2001, and we felt that growing the whole Disneyland resort was and should be a priority for the company, and one way to do that, even though there's still room to invest in Disneyland on its own, one way to do that was to fix the issue that we had at California Adventure. Hong Kong opened in 2005. We said all along when we opened Hong Kong that we were going to expand it, and that's what we're doing now. They were all separate decisions, and I think good decisions. The good news is that from a creative perspective, the company, to the point that Steve was making earlier, the company is richer in terms of intellectual property. Therefore, when you look at these parks, you're going to see examples of the success that we've had on the intellectual property front in all of these places.
More tools to use.
Okay. Sophie, I have some questions from the audience. If we can just on the parks, and one of the questions is, obviously, in light of the uncertainty coming out of Europe and don't know where attendance will be at the parks over the balance of the summer, can we expect discounting to come back if attendance stays weak at the parks?
We make decisions on discounting individually, meaning the decision on Paris will be made separate and apart from what we're doing domestically.
I think this is also
on the Paris front. I think we're still watching. It's obviously an uncertain economy, and we're still watching the marketplace very carefully, although we haven't had significant issues to date, save for what you'd expect from an economy that has not been that robust. On the U.S. front, we said at earnings that it's our goal to essentially eliminate the discounting that we put in place during this recent economic downturn by 2011. There's always some discounting during off-peak periods, but the primary discounts we were applying, we would wean ourselves of, and that is still our goal. We've seen since earnings, I mentioned at earnings that we had an uptick in our then most recent bookings, and that trend has continued nicely in the 4 or 5 weeks since earnings. Now, we still have a long summer to go, but we're encouraged so far with what we've seen on the bookings front. And that would lead us to believe that our prediction in terms of weaning ourselves of the discount was a good one, but we'll see.
Okay. Here, this might be my favorite question. The second part will be my favorite question, but it's, first of all, please provide us with an update on the upfront market for ABC in the coming year.
Why is that your favorite question?
No, the second part. This is called the tease, Bob. It's like after the break. We'll
We're in the middle of selling. We said at earnings that we thought it was going to be a good upfront because of how we were positioned, but also because the scatter was so strong and we've seen some improvement in the economy. It's too early to actually say, but what the business that we've written so far, and we've written some, has been good and in line with what we expected.
Okay, so this is one final Lost question remains unanswered. Rumor has it you were the voiceover for Previously on Lost before each episode. True or false?
False.
Okay,
I was thinking maybe of not responding to that, but right. it was endless speculation. probably haunt me for the rest of my career.
SAG after card.
I have a DGA card.
Right. Okay, but not a SAG after card.
Now,
one of the thoughts when we were talking about content and distribution is there's been two big events in the content and distribution place from competitors of yours over the last year, Time Warner splitting off the cable entity and obviously Comcast in the process of acquiring NBC. If you could talk about how you think those two events affect your business and the content distribution relationship.
I don't think they affect us at all. The spinoff of cable and Time Warner was a decision they made, obviously, without consulting us. It doesn't affect us. And Comcast buying NBC, we don't really see necessarily changing things either. It's too early to speculate how they're going to run those assets, what they're going to do with those assets, which ones they'll keep, which ones they'll invest more in. And so, we know what our hand is, and we're really focused on strengthening it in ways that we've pretty much described this morning, and we don't think that the competitive landscape changes in any significant way because of the divestiture or the acquisition.
Although I'm sure some people do think, and this is another question that might be related to the Comcast NBC thing, is what do you think are the most significant long-term threats to the ESPN franchise? Now, there's certainly been a lot of speculation about Comcast and NBC having some assets, combining those assets on the sports franchise, the sports world, that might pose a threat to ESPN.
I can't name any specific threat to ESPN right now that would rise to the level of, oh my God, the value of the asset is in peril.
Right.
There's nothing along those lines. Fortunately, we have a good hand, a good competitive position, long-term relationships with leagues, and a great brand. And we're not going to be complacent about that, which is evident in our continued investment in that product, but I don't see an imminent threat. On the Comcast-NBC front, both Comcast and NBC were already competitors on the sports side, NBC with football and the Olympics and other sports they've been involved in, and Comcast with its own sports network and regional sports networks. And I don't think that the combination of the two will necessarily change how they compete. What will be most interesting will be to see whether Comcast takes a different approach to buying sports for the network, since they actually said themselves that, or NBC and GE said, that the sports packages on the network, NBC, lost considerable money in the recent past. And whether Comcast will take an approach that enables those losses to be sustained or do something differently. You could actually conclude that it might be better in a way, but that would be sheer speculation.
But there's always a buyer who ends up willing to lose money.
There has always been keen competition for great sporting events, and there's also always been enough great sporting events for ESPN to buy to continue to grow its product and to continue to create value. And we're very optimistic about ESPN's abilities to continue to grow and continue to be a rather important asset for this company.
The lens through which you evaluate the return on invested capital in sports programming, has that changed much, or are there future revenue streams when you're thinking about the returns or the ultimates on buying that programming that you're including, or do returns go down specifically as you need to create this moat, as you've talked about in the past, for ESPN to remain relevant as a top-tier cable network?
I don't really see returns over the long run changing that much at ESPN unless the competitive landscape changes significantly. And I said a moment ago, I don't think that there's imminent threat from that happening. The investment ESPN is making has now included what I'll call new platform rights, and that's added some expense, but it's relatively modest compared with the total expense of buying all those sports rights. And ESPN has used its relationships with the leagues and its ability to provide these leagues with great marketing opportunities to gain access to a broader array of rights, because the leagues, in most cases, have concluded that's good for them. And I think that dynamic is going to continue. We're going to continue to invest to grow ESPN sub fees, to grow ESPN's advertising, and to grow brand strength. And we're also going to continue to be disciplined, too. We're not going to say yes to everything. We have recently turned away some sports that had been on ESPN. We have bid aggressively for certain things. The NCAA March Madness or basketball championships is a good example of something that we went after quite aggressively, but just got to a point where we felt that we had gone as high as we wanted to go, and we were outbid. Not something that we had previously, something we would have had, but we just felt that the likely returns for us to go any higher would not have been keeping with the long-term interests of ESPN or the shareholders of the company. And we're going to continue to take that approach. We know we cannot buy everything. We know that we have to buy a fair amount to continue to grow the value. And there are going to be times when we really step up, as we've demonstrated, and there are going to be times when we walk away.
You talked about growing sub fees, and obviously you had a contentious negotiation with Cablevision.
On retransmission.
But it's all related to money that the cable multi-channel provider is sending Disney's way. Are there lessons that you learned from that discussion, that negotiation with Cablevision, that you will take forward as you enter the new round of negotiations on ESPN? I guess you start with Time Warner Cable this summer.
I don't know that there are necessarily. Well, if there are lessons, they're not any that I'd really want to share.
Okay.
Maybe that's the best way to put it. But the conclusion, obviously, that everyone should reach is that there's value being provided by these great TV stations, particularly in big markets, value that cable entities are ultimately willing to pay and willing to recognize. And all of broadcasting should benefit from that, as have others already. There's just real value there.
Another question, talks about the intellectual property that you have and exploiting that. And I guess a large concern, as you talked before about piracy, is how do you make sure that you can preserve the intellectual property in emerging markets?
Providing full protection of our intellectual property in emerging markets is right now impossible. A lot of it has to do with access, that in the absence of access, which is either prevented because of lack of infrastructure or regulation, people are going to gain access to our intellectual property illegally. And it speaks to what we've said as a company for a long time, and that is the best way to fight piracy is to be enter the market on a well-priced, well-timed basis. In the absence of that, piracy is significant and will grow, and that's what's going on in these markets. The other ways to prevent it would obviously create and enforce laws and education. Education seems to be pretty difficult. Creating and enforcing laws, there are varying degrees of success or lack thereof, and our approach, therefore, in these markets is work really hard, which is what we're doing, to get the product in there legitimately. Launching channels and getting more movies to market. Russia's a good example, actually. I'm just looking at the results for Prince of Persia and Alice in Wonderland. You've had huge growth in the movie industry in Russia very recently. So movie companies, U.S. in particular, are having much more success at getting their films into Russia on the big screen legitimately. And that will reduce piracy because in the past, if people couldn't watch the movies because the screens didn't exist, they figured out other ways to do that. Now they're stepping up and paying for it, and it's a great thing. The box office that we're delivering, that the industry is deriving actually from Russia, has really become significant. So it's about legitimate means of entering the marketplace.
Okay. And then one other question is, in spite of Disney, in spite of a tremendous portfolio of great brands, only earns a subpar return on equity of around 11%-12%. How do you reconcile this versus what you think obviously the higher return that this questioner would expect based on the brands that you have?
Well, versus what?
Well, my assumption
compared to the rest of the industry,
I think it's also versus if you thought a portfolio of brands that a Procter and Gamble might have.
You have it's a completely different profile. Even though we have certain brands that are evergreen in value or in nature, they require a significant amount of investment on the development and the creative front regularly. And so Procter and Gamble, which is a great company, in fact, we have two former executives of Procter and Gamble on our board, would be politically incorrect for me to say anything negative about this. While they invest a lot in R&D and continue to try to make their brands better, once you develop Pampers, you put it into the marketplace and manufacture, you don't necessarily have to reinvent it from scratch every year. When you're talking about Disney movies, even though you make a movie and it has a lifespan that lasts for a long, long time, witness Cinderella or Snow White, you still pretty much have to reinvent your array of products every year. Television the same in similar fashion. So your return, your ROE is, I think, affected by that.
So in that case,
I think, though, from an industry perspective, our industry, I think we stand up really well against all others.
So what other metrics, you've talked about return on invested capital is one of the key metrics.
Yeah, we look at economic profit, return on invested capital. We're still trying to grow free cash flow. We're still intent on growing earnings per share, operating income, net operating income. Those are all, by the way, metrics that are used to determine executive compensation as well. And they remain our primary focus.
I think we'll get you out of here 2 minutes early. If Michael was here with somebody else.
Michael was here with the questions that have been tougher or longer, I don't know.
They would have been
took two of you to replace him, so
exactly.
That says a lot.
The questions would have been longer. But thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.